come up on the tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. I'm very excited about this show for two reasons. Well, multiple reasons, but number one is we have the poet Natalie Diaz on the show. She is author of When My Brother Was an Aztec, which is, I personally think, one of the most beautiful book of poems in the last several years, and we're going to talk to her about that book. I'm also excited because, as you may have noticed, I've been doing a lot of shows alone lately. My very good friend Benjamin Alida Sines, there is always an empty seat in this studio for him, and it's right there anytime he wants to sit in it. So my very good friend, who's better friend, Ben or Tim? I don't know, but my very good friend Tim Z. Hernandez is in the studio with me. He's going to co-host today's show, and he is going to become another host of Words on a Wire. Welcome, Tim, Words on a Wire, not as a guest, but as a host.
I know. Thank you so much. It feels great. It feels great to be here. I'd like to thank all the little people. No, this is going to be great. I'm excited about it, yeah.
I'm going to be traveling a lot, and so you're going to be doing shows on your own.
Yep, looking forward to it.
And you've had a radio show before.
No, you know, I've done a lot of radio interviews, but I haven't had a radio show. But you know what? That is, I kid you not, that's one of the things on my 100 Things to Do in This Life list is have a radio show.
Wow, that's awesome.
This is a dream come true for me.
That's cool. So you're a little closer to dying.
That's right. A little bit. Every day, yep.
But anyway, I'm really glad you're going to be on the show.
Hey, me too. I know. Me too. I'm a longtime fan of the show.
And it's good that we're inaugurating your being a host and interviewing Natalie Diaz, who is a friend of yours.
Yeah, who's a friend of mine and really just an amazing poet who I've admired her work since I first got my hands on her book, you know, When My Brother Was an Aztec. She's phenomenal.
Yeah, definitely. I can't wait for her next book to come out.
I know.
I'm going to be the first one in line to buy that. It's going to be like Harry Potter.
Yeah.
You know how people like, they think all around the block to get Harry Potter. Well, I'm going to be, I don't know if there'll be a line, but I'm going to be in it.
Yeah, you'll be in sleeping
bag. I'll be a line of one if I have to be.
All right. I'll be out there taking pictures of you.
Okay. So let's go ahead and talk to Natalie Diaz. Stick around. You're going to love this show.
Wonderful.
And Tim, welcome.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure. Natalie Diaz is a member of the Mojave and Pima Indian tribes. She attended Old Dominion University on a full athletic scholarship. After she played basketball in Austria and Spain and other parts of the world, she finally came back to ODU for her MFA in creative writing. She has several publications in places like Prairie Schooner and Iowa Review and Crab Orchard Review and many others. Her first collection of poetry, When My Brother Was an Aztec, was published by Copper Canyon Press. And we're just happy to have her on today's show. Natalie Diaz, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Yeah, welcome to you guys too, to my home here in Arizona. It's good to be with you guys.
Where in Arizona are you right now?
I'm in Fort Mojave, so Mojave Valley, right across the river from Needles, California.
How does that landscape that you live in and that you clearly are so comfortable in, how does that affect the way you write poetry?
I wonder about that. I mean, I think space, you know, there's so much space out here. There's so much sky. There's so much room, I think, to think. And so, you know, I think just kind of the freedom of space, it really gives me a certain type of freedom on the page. Like I feel like a line can go on forever if it needs to. You know, it can kind of wander and explore, you know, all across the page and down the page. But at the same time, you know, I think it's, you know, a line can also be something short, or I think there's a certain kind of balance between precision and wildness that I bring to my page that happens in the desert, you know, where I live as well. So.
How long have you been going back and forth, you know, in these last, I guess, what has it been, like a couple of years that you've been going between New York and back to home there, what you call home? Because I would imagine, too, that also plays sort of, you know, having that sort of vantage point to look at your own community from a distance, right, plays a role in the way that you're able to look at it.
Yeah, well, I've kind of always been going, you know, back and forth a little bit. It hasn't been until the last few years that I moved back home. So doing that was kind of actually the rubber band motion, because I wrote the first book largely while I was away, you know, while I was doing like my MFA and then traveling after that. And so it was actually coming back home over these last few years and spending time here, because the trips like to New York and for all of the readings, I've just been basically traveling nonstop for the last 2 years.
Wow.
But it's just been coming back home, I think, that's given me just a different kind of, like, a different viewpoint or vantage point. You know, I feel like I'm looking more closely at things, you know, like, I mean, there's some poems I've been writing, and they started with just me taking this desert run I do behind my house, mm-hmm. and seeing a coyote that had, like, after a storm, it had come up from under the brush, like a dead coyote.
Wow.
And I think it must have been poisoned from, like, the fields, because none of the animals, like, none of the carrion would bother it.
Sure.
But just so, like, every day for 2 months, I just watched it.
Wow.
You know, every time I went out for a run, I just watched it, like, become less and less and kind of be taken back into the dirt, really.
Right.
You know, so it's things like that. Being back home, I feel like I'm just looking more closely now, you know, at the small things that end up meaning much larger things. So
we're talking to Natalie Diaz, author of When My Brother Was an Aztec, out by Copper Canyon Press. It's a beautiful book of poems. I used it in a class, in a graduate poetry seminar. And one of the things I told my students, you know, as a prompt to begin the discussion, is to look at some of the images like paintings, because they're so detailed. And one of my students says, you know, these aren't like paintings. These are more like installations that you walk into,
wow,
which I thought was really, really beautiful. But there's a lot of painful moments in this poem. There's a lot of, especially with the brother and his addiction. And I'm wondering, how did this book come about? Was it that you were just writing poems and then suddenly you realized you had a book? Or did you know that some of the themes of this book were going to create a book?
Yeah, I mean, I've yet to experience, I think, like the book project or the book structure. I mean, this book came about just, I mean, these are the things that I write about. I think even the second book, I'm still wrestling with a lot of the same questions and wonders. But yeah, I tend to write about the things that I worry about, or you know, the things that I'm afraid of. And you know, in my life right now, there are a lot of different roles I have in my life right now, and I don't know how that will change in the next 5 years or 10 years, but you know, for now, that's just what I try to do, is I just try to listen to all of those, you know, different voices and questions. And so that tends to be what I'm writing about, even now, just as it was in the first book, a gauge, I guess, of my mind.
Right, right.
But does that mean sometimes that some of these poems, were they difficult to write, or was it more therapeutic? I mean, how does that work on an emotional level?
Yeah, well, I mean, I imagine that they're therapeutic. I know some people cringe when they hear someone say therapy.
Yeah,
like, oh my God, it's art, you know, it's art and literature, it's not therapy. It's, you know, any therapy I can squeeze out would probably be a good thing. So
yeah.
I don't, and I think it is a way that I deal with it, and I think it's a way that's been different than the way other family members have dealt with this or other community members. But I think, for me, you know, I believe in the mask of the eye, and so I do have a real brother, and I am a real sister. But when I come to the page, you know, those emotions are mine, and you know, the fears and worries I have for my real brother, like, those are mine, and those are real. But I do, you know, I really trust the mask of the eye in the poem, and the mask of the Aztec that the brother wears in the poem. And so for me, you know, even though that eye that I'm using in the poems is very close to me, the poet,
right.
We're not the same person. And so there's something for me that is, it's like a tool, or it's like a, you know, it's almost like a, I mean, silly, but like kind of this like super power, you know, I get to put it on. And so what it allows me to do is chase down these questions or chase down these fears or these worries, and get as close to them as I can, that I can't get that close to them in real life.
Right.
You know, like, of course my brother does not look like a Halloween costume, but in real life he looks worse, and I couldn't possibly explain that to you.
Right.
And so when I put these masks on, I get to get close enough that I can at least you know, look some of those ugly things in the eye, look some of those emotions in the eye, and deal with them. And so for me, the image to me is so important. Like, I think my poems are largely, I mean, they're narrative, but they're largely image driven. And for me, like, an image is not just a picture or a thing that you can, like, see or touch. Like, to me, an image is so much more capable of holding emotion than words we typically think of as emotional. And so that's something that, you know, makes it easier. I mean, there are some days when I read some of those poems when I'm a little, you know, just personally a little bit more vulnerable, and so I feel them in a different way. But often as I go through and read them, like, I can lose myself in the language and the image and how it was built. But yeah, so there were poems that didn't make the book because they didn't feel that way. They felt too personal. They felt too close to me.
And what are you going to do with those poems? Are they ever going to come out?
Yeah, as of right now, nothing. I mean, I haven't published them. I haven't, you know, I kind of trust that gauge that I have, you know, because I feel like there's really no place that I cannot go or that I cannot delve. And, you know, I'm really curious. I have a lot of questions and, you know, I always have. And so I've always had this, like, freedom of luxury, you know, just wondering them you know, thinking about them. But, you know, if there's ever something that I second guess, like, I trust that in me, you know, and so who knows what will happen to them at another point. But at least right now they're probably lost on some floppy disk somewhere.
Floppy disk.
Oh, those are old phones.
You know, I think that you really articulate that very well in an essay that you wrote, I think, earlier this year, I, Judas Horse, where you use that sort of idea of the Judas horse as a way to write about one's loved ones as material for your poetry. Can you tell me just a little bit more about what that Judas horse, that sort of image and that idea?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I came across it on an airplane. Like, I don't know, I fly, so they give you, like, free TV and miles and, I don't know, internet and things. And so I was just watching, like, this documentary on the wild horse gathers that the BLM does. You know, they do it across, like, New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, California. But, you know, it was just crazy to me to see that the BLM would train this horse and kind of hide it, you know, so it was like this educated horse, you know, and they would hide it in, like, a copse of, like, trees. And then when these wild Mustangs would come by, they'd let the horse loose, and he would kind of move into the herd. You know, and he was a horse as well. He was like them, but, you know, again, he's had this distance and this education, and he would move into these horses, and then he would lead them toward this capture corral where they would all be captured. And so, you know, they were calling, you know, just like they have the Judas goat and these things, but he was the Judas horse. And I'm just kind of fascinated right now anyway with the wild Mustangs and their plight and what's happening to them. But there was just, you know, and especially because they say, you know, a lot of these horses were left over from cavalry, and, you know, the cavalry was so just detrimental to my tribe and my people. I mean, to millions of people, you know, across the United States. But, it just felt like such a connection to me. And I, it was somehow just in watching that, I had, like, a different realization of guilt. And I don't know that it's guilt I carry in terms of being the writer, but just there's a guilt that you have, I think most of us have, when we come home. Like, you know, we always hear, like, the hardest thing to do for a lot of us in small communities or in ethnic communities or in minority communities is to leave home. But, like, what I found is the toughest thing is to return home. You know, because all of a sudden you have this gauge and this measurement that you say, hey, that's not right, or I can't look at that anymore, or, you know, and for me, I think that's the guilt. It's not the guilt that I'm writing about my brother, but it's just this guilt that I've come back to my life and to my family with, I mean, as a slightly different person.
Right.
You know, and there's, I think, a fine line between me seeing it as judgment or seeing it as knowledge or seeing it as realization. You know, I don't spend too much time trying to separate all those. You know, I know they're very close together, but you know, it's a burden. It's an emotional burden, I think. And I get that question a lot, you know, like, well, how can you write that about your brother? And, you know, and I'm still writing about these things. And, you know, I just wrote an essay recently for Penn about this. And it's, you know, in that essay, I kind of compared it to quantum theory, you know, like mm-hmm. when Einstein said, like, do you really think the moon only exists when you're looking at it? And, like, and for me, there's something about acknowledging my brother, even in this, like, wrecked state that he's in, and saying, like, yeah, like, he's still my brother, and I'm still his sister, and me looking away from it doesn't change that. Like, right. me looking away from it is saying, like, he's a lost cause, like, he doesn't deserve right. my hope. I think any of us who are writing about a family, like, we, you know, we struggle with it because it's also our truth and it's our emotion and it's our story. And you know, and even though I am writing about him and the images are grotesque at times and they're terrible and emotional and painful, I mean, it's also one way that I'm able to love my brother. I mean, I can hold my brother with a tenderness that in real life I don't have the opportunity to do very often. In the ways that I'm able to hold him in a poem on a page,
right.
even if it is just to describe his body. You know, like, I don't know when the last time I embraced my brother physically in real life in a loving way.
Right.
And to me, like, one of the best ways I can love him, even if it also involves a little bit of frustration or pain or disgust even, is on the page.
I'm wondering how that guilt is affected by the success of the book itself. When My Brother Was an Aztec is an incredibly well-received book. You got Copper Canyon, which is undoubtedly one of the best poetry presses in the nation. Not anyone can get right. published with them. You were invited to the Dodge Poetry Festival. You just, you know, have this incredible reputation with this one book because it's just so amazing. And how, I wonder if that success of the book kind of deepens the guilt. Like, if nobody was reading your book, would you feel as guilty?
I don't know. My brother said, the other day, my brother said I owed him $6,000 because of this book. So, he obviously doesn't understand poetry. I don't know, because, I mean, something for me that's still very important is that, you know, from the cover of the book to the language that I use, like, I'm still telling stories the way that I was taught to tell them, you know, and it's important for me that people who are like me and that people who come from the same place as I've come from are able to find themselves somehow in this book. And, you know, I hear from a lot of people, like, there was a young woman who told me that her father, you know, she was estranged from her father most of her life up until, you know, I guess the last few years. But she said that she read the book and she immediately knew she wanted to give it to her father as a gift. And so she said she gave it to him and he loved it. And, like, he took it to his, like, NA groups because he's recovered now. But she said, like, the conversation she had with him was about how it let him see some of the things he did in a different way. You know, and so, I mean, I do believe in the power of poetry because I believe in the power of storytelling to offer us, you know, connections that, especially now in this world, it's so hard to make, which is just to say, like, you know, I'm human and I'm messed up and I'm not perfect and I'm never going to be perfect and I keep making mistakes. But guess what? Like, I also deserve to be loved. I also want to love. I'm glad that people are reading the book and that it's getting to a lot of the corners, and not just, like, the academic corners, but
right.
it's getting into hands of people like me who needed it when I was a kid. Like, you know, I was not the ideal candidate for poetry, you know,
right.
but it's made a huge impact in my life. And so, you know, I guess it's like with anything, you know, if you fix a car and it runs down the road, like, you did something, that you feel good about it. And so when I hear people give me feedback that just says, you know, not that it saved their life or changed their life, but just that they were able to find themselves in it,
right.
you know, there's something that makes me feel good just about the work that I've done.
And speaking of the cover, you mentioned the cover. It's this beautiful photograph of this young man looking very angry in an Aztec outfit, sitting on a couch in a clearly Catholic home, which I think represents, you know, very well your bicultural status of being part Mexican, Chicana, part Native American. Who did this image? How did this image come about? It's not your real brother.
And it is, I think it is your real brother, right?
Yeah, it's my little brother.
No way.
He's not little, though. He's pretty giant.
Yeah.
Oh,
I was gonna say.
He looks quite intimidating. He looks very angry.
Yeah, he always looks mad. He's a little punk. No, this is my little brother. But, Copper Canyon was great. They sent me an image by Graciela Iturbide.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It was beautiful. But it was, I think it was a photo taken in Oaxaca, and, you know, we're big people, you know, and so I was like, man, we could put like 12 of those people in that picture in my pocket. I'm just kidding. But, before I responded to them, and, you know, the picture was beautiful. It was of a Dia de los Muertos a gathering of some sort. But I had a friend, my friend Mary Westbrook, and she's a writer, and her husband, who's a photographer, Roberto, they were down visiting. And I showed them the photo and just kind of explained to them that I didn't think that represented the people in the book. And he's like, well, you know, if you want, you know, we can kind of mess around and see if we can do something kind of tongue-in-cheek. And then about that time, which my younger brother often does, if there's company, he came, because he lives two houses down from me. We live in a small place, a small area, but he comes jogging to the door with no shirt on, you know, as he does often to kind of, Berto was like, hey man, would your brother be up for doing a photo? And I didn't think my brother would be, but he said he was one of like the best models he's worked with. And so we just went to my mom's house and, you know, like, I mean, we were laughing cause you can see like the waistband of my brother's underwear, but like we wanted it to just be kind of like surreal, kind of, you know, which is real. Yeah. And then, but yeah, that's my mom's living room and all those photos. Like, so it's kind of cool because my brothers and sisters, they can all find themselves in there. Yeah. You know, someone's first communion is up there. So there's a bunch of stuff, but yeah, it worked out really well. And Copper Canyon was great. And I just felt like this picture did what, you know, it's like, people from where I'm from can look at this and see themselves. Like my brother is, you know, he's a big guy. Like we are down this way. So
we're talking to Natalie Diaz, author of When My Brother Was an Aztec. I love this book of poems. Tim obviously loves this book of poems. Would you be willing to read a poem for us? We have this segment called Poem of the Week, and when we have a fantastic poet, we'd like to hear them read a poem, if that's possible.
Yes, I can read that one. The Gospel of Guy No Horse. At the engine that could, a jalopy bar drooping and lopsided on the bank of the Colorado River, a once mighty red body, now dammed and tamed blue, Guy No Horse was glistening, drunk, and dancing fancy with two white gals, both yellow-haired tourists still in bikini tops, freckled skins, blistered pink, by the savage Mojave Desert sun. Though the engine, as it was known by locals, had no true dance floor, truths meant little on such a night. Card tables covered in drink, ash, and melting ice had been pushed aside, shoved together to make a place for the rhythms that came easy to people in the coyote hours beyond midnight. In the midst of camel smoke hanging lower and thicker than a September monsoon, no horse rode high, his PINC-issued wheelchair transfigured, a magical chariot drawn by two blonde beer-clumsy palominos, perfumed with coconut sunscreen and $1.50 Budweisers. He was as careful as any man could be at almost 2 a.m. to avoid their their sunburned toes. In the brown light of the engine, chips in their toenail polish glinted like diamonds. Other Indians noticed the awkward trinity and gathered round in a dented circle, clapping, whooping, slinging obscenities from their tongues of fire. Yaha! Yaha! Jeering their dark horse, no horse, toward the finish line of an obviously rigged race. No horse didn't hear their rabble, which was soon overpowered as the two-man band behind the bar really got after it, a jam probably about love, but maybe about freedom, and definitely about him, as his fair-haired tandem, his denim-skirted pendulums kept time, the time being now. No horse sucked his lips, imagined the taste of the white girl's thrusting hips. Hey, he sang. Hey, he smiled. Hey, he spun around in the middle of a crowd of his fellow tribesmen, a sparkling centurion moving as fluid as an Indian could be at almost 2 a.m, rolling back, forth, popping wheelies that tipped his big head and swung his braids like shiny lassos of lust. The two white gals looked down at him, looked back up at each other, raised their plastic solo cups runneth over, laughing loudly, hysterical, at the very thought of dancing with a broken-down Indian. But about that laughter, no horse didn't give a damn. This was an edge of res where warriors were made on nights like these, with music like this. And tonight he was out, dancing at the engine that could. If you'd seen the lightning of his smile, not the empty space leaking from his thighs, you might have believed that man was walking on water, or at least that he had legs again. And as for the white girls slurring around him like two bedraggled angels, one holding on to the handle of his wheelchair, the other spilling her drink all down the front of her shirt, well, for them, he was sorry, because this was not a John Wayne movie. This was the engine that could, and the only cavalry riding this night was a no horse's veins. Hey, hey. Hey, he hollered.
That was Natalie Diaz reading from her book, When My Brother Was an Aztec. Thank you so much, Natalie. When can we expect your next collection?
Well, it was supposed to be out at the end of 2015, but I just bumped it back to AWP 2016.
Nice. So well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
That's, well, we look forward to that.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you, Natalie.
We'd like to thank our guest, Natalie Diaz, for joining us on Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank our producer, Norma Martinez, who is the best producer in the entire world. And I know that because I know every producer in the entire world. And Tim, thank you for being now a host on Words on a Wire.
It's a pleasure. That's my first one. I look forward to many more.
Right on. And we will have many more wonderful guests like Natalie Diaz. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
And don't forget, the next book you read
could save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game.